Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 179, A Psychobiological Approach to Couples Therapy, October 24th, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Two people together really, we're talking two brains, two autonomic nervous systems getting together and trying to get along at close physical distances. And that's a tough thing to do. We're generally wired to survive and to keep at a distance and to be suspicious and to run or fight when we need to. So to get together with somebody romantically and to maintain that contact with them in close physical proximity over time without becoming threatened or threatening is really quite an amazing human capacity.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Stan Tatkin, founder and developer of A Psychobiological Approach to Couples Therapy, which integrates neuroscience, infant attachment, arousal regulation, and therapeutic enactment applied to adult primary attachment relationships. You can find out more about Dr. Tatkin in our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Stan Tatkin, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David.
Well, let's start off by, first of all, I want to mention that it was a listener in London who told me about your work and who suggested that I should interview you.
Wow.
And I think it was a great suggestion. So let's start off by having you tell us a bit about your background, you know, where you grew up, went to school, all that good stuff.
Going all the way back to elementary school.
maybe not quite that far.
I should say that my first career was as a professional musician. So that was my first half of my life.
Oh, what instrument?
Drums.
Ah, interesting.
I came from a musical family. And it wasn't really until my late 20s that I went into this field. And it's been a love affair ever since. I originally went to Pepperdine.
Oh, yes, I know that school.
Yes, Pepperdine, Malibu. And I lucked into very early on. I had some very good supervisors. My first training with, I think a lot of people like this, was in family systems. And then from there to Gestalt. And then I lucked into a job as an intern with John Bradshaw, who at the time was an ascending figure in the media.
Yes, I remember the years when he was on TV. He was kind of the Dr. Phil of that period.
He was really something. He was on PBS. And,
yes.
At the time when I first saw him, I didn't really understand his appeal. But as I got to know him, and certainly as I worked for him, I understood really what he had done. He brought people into therapy at that time who never considered it because his was a 12-step model, and he really integrated quite a bit of material. And himself a very good teacher. So he set up an inpatient program, and I was one of the group therapists for that program. And this was really where I cut my teeth. It was a very difficult experience in the trenches with, this is during the days of 30-day, 60-day inpatient stays for depression. And so we would do these intense groups, 2.5-hour, 2 times a day groups.
Oh, my goodness.
And and a lot of the patient population was very difficult. From there, because I needed more tools to survive in that environment, I met or came across James Masterson, who out of New York ran the and still runs the Masterson Institute, and it was through.
Now, I've heard that, you know, his name is very familiar, but I'm not quite sure what the context is. What's he known for?
He is known for American object relations, kind of a model built on Margaret Mahler's early work with separation individuation and Kernberg's work with borderlines. And Masterson was making a claim at that time that he could successfully work with borderlines and narcissistic disorders to the point where they would become psychoneurotic. So I found that very interesting, and I got into psychoanalytic object relations theory, but on the American object relations side.
Okay.
And so, you know, after immersing myself in that, when I stopped working at Bradshaw, I started to specialize in my practice working with Axis 2, personality disorders, which I found to actually like to work with. And from there, I was teaching at the time, and I started getting more and more interested in development and how people got to this point. And in my teaching, I started to get involved in attachment theory. I came across a frontline video called "When the Bout Breaks." And this is a program up in Canada, the Hinks Institute, the Muirs. And this program worked on prevention working with mother-infant pairs or caregiver pairs. And in just about 8 weeks of intervention with a problem having to do with a baby who was not developing because of insecure attachment, would turn around not so much the mother or the father, but the trajectory of this baby and what looked to be possibly a lifelong problem, relationship problem, if you followed the trajectory, or an Axis 2 problem. With these minor changes, this baby now, you could imagine, would possibly just be neurotic. And I thought, you know, this is where it's at, prevention. You know, rather than working reconstructively, why not start at the beginning and work with these mother-infant pairs? And so I retooled my office and started setting up for video, and that's what I wanted to do. Around this time, I was introduced to a man, Alan Shore, and some of your listeners may or may not know who he is. Alan came onto the scene a little more than 10 years ago with a groundbreaking book synthesizing brain development with attachment, with psychoanalytic theory. And I was fortunate enough to meet him, and I started studying with him and been with him for about 10 or 11 years. Through him, I got into infant brain development and attachment.
What's the title of that book, in case anyone's interested in following up on that?
Well, he's had several. The original book is Affect Regulation and the Origin of the Self, the Neurobiology of Emotional Development.
That's a mouthful.
Yeah, it's a mouthful. And it's I'm not going to say it's an easy read.
Okay.
It's not. But he's since he has two other books that are out that that I think are very nice. Dysregulation of the Right Brain, or actually it's Affect Dysregulation and Disorders of the Self, and Affect Regulation and Repair of the Self. But anyway, through him, I began to put together the psychobiological model that I'm using now with couples. I fell into couples work. Not exactly sure how, but I did. I ended up applying everything that I understood and learned about infant attachment and brain development and started applying it to couples. And somehow I became a couples expert.
That's fascinating because when most of us think about couples, we don't think about their brains.
That's right. Two people together, really, you know, we're talking the two brains, two autonomic nervous systems getting together and trying to get along at close physical distances. And that's a tough thing to do. We're generally wired to survive and to keep at a distance and to be suspicious and to run or fight when we need to. So to get together with somebody romantically and to maintain that contact with them in close physical proximity over time without becoming threatened or threatening is really quite an amazing human capacity, considering what can happen and what does happen.
Yes, you made I was reading some of the papers that you sent me, and I was struck by a very startling statement in which you said, the human brain and nervous system is built for war, not love.
Yeah, we're really built much more for war. When we look at how the brain has evolved and the parts of the brain that run the show, basically the parts of the brain that have their ear to the ground, so to speak, for danger and threat, those parts of the brain, subcortical parts of the brain, are always on and always sweeping the environment. And depending on our early experience, what it sweeps for and what it finds and how it determines danger, you know, it varies between people. But basically, first and foremost, we're built to stay alive. The ability to choose and to choose love over war, or to choose one's own moral beliefs over pressure, you know, to survive. That really requires high-level, higher cortical brain function and early development to be able to do that.
So how does your knowledge of the brain impact the way that you work with couples? And I'm kind of leaping ahead over a lot of theoretical stuff that we could be talking about, but...
Oh, there's a lot. Well, if you understand how the brain works and how it develops from the very beginning and how critical the first 18 months of life are, and arguably even pre- and perinatal life, and how these neural pathways develop throughout the lifespan, you start to understand that there are certain capacities that we develop because of good you know, environment, good nurturing, good genes, where certain parts of the brain that specialize in social emotional acuity, in other words, being able to read faces, read voices, read intent, to be able to read one's own body and to be able to bring that up into awareness and then to be able to quickly make use of that. These are all faculties that are developed very, very early on. And not that they can't be developed later, but there are critical periods of development where these functions develop better. And so understanding how that works and the parts of the brain that are involved in that, and basically we're talking about the right hemisphere, which tends to develop prior to the left hemisphere. The brainstem, the visual centers that are online at birth, even though the eyes, the pupils aren't fully developed, there's still a visual capacity and a reliance. We humans are very visual. The limbic circuit, limbic areas that are developed and online at birth. These areas are very fast-acting, very quick appraisal systems that are nonverbal. They're implicit systems, and we just know how to do it. We know how to read a face. We know how to understand a tone of voice. We know how to understand a movement, a touch. And our ability to appraise this very quickly and to respond to it very quickly, it really determines how well we get along with people, how we empathize, how quickly we understand other people. Of course, those of us who have the better development and more security in childhood were these right hemisphere limbic and these frontal cortical areas are developed. Even if we don't have great education, we tend to move very well in the world because we can get along with more people. People tend to be drawn to us. Again, we have empathy. We're able to manage ourselves and to work with other people at close distances. So the parts of the brain, understanding how development works and how the brain works, helps us understand why there are certain people in close attachment or primary attachment relationships, why they might have a hard time, perhaps understanding cues from their partner, understanding what's going on in their body and be able to make use of that, able to make contingent responses to novel reactions by a partner without going into threat. That's one part of it. The other part of it, and this is something that I became very, very interested in as I developed my work, is the autonomic nervous system piece. And just very briefly, autonomic nervous system, two branches, sympathetic, which is the arousing, exciting branch, and parasympathetic, which is the relaxing, calming branch. This plays a huge role, not only in infant attachment, but in adult romantic relationships. We're talking about two nervous systems getting together and being able to co-manage each other's arousal in real time at close distances, and to be able to do that without frightening each other or, when making mistakes, being able to error correct and fix those errors quickly so that there isn't a buildup of threat and then a consequential pattern of avoidance of moving away. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes. You say, in what I read, you said that couple relationships are all about mutual regulation of arousal and security.
That's right.
And that's what you're talking about now.
The security here, you know, a lot of these terms get bandied about and have different meaning in different quarters. When I say security, I'm talking about in a couple system that there is a basic awareness, mutual awareness of the need to create and maintain safety for one another. That's different than security in infant mother studies. It's quite possible for people to be insecure and to gain a secure relationship and remain somewhat insecure as individuals. The relationship here I'm talking about is secure in that both partners see themselves as responsible for maintaining the safety and security system at all times so that neither feel basically fundamentally threatened about the other person leaving, hurting, rejecting, whatever. The other part of it, though, is the nervous system. And this is something that is very dicey because these right brain processes that I talked about, they're very, very fast acting, faster than words, faster than cognition. And so we're at close distances, we're appraising and we're reacting to one another very, very quickly, much faster than we are actually aware of consciously. Two people who get together and their ability to be able to calm each other down when in distress is really key, is really crucial. Some people can't do that very well.
Yeah, I'm thinking, what about the opposite of that, where I know sometimes in my own marriage relationship, we can just set each other off faster than the speed of thought, you know, in terms of getting into an argument. Just be very reactive, and it's so quick.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yes.
And it really is a no-fault thing. Couples therapy tends to focus on a conflict model rather than a deficit model, deficit meaning that people are doing the best they can, but there are certain areas where they're not very good at doing certain things, certain things they may not be able to control very well, like immediately being able to calm down or not having the amygdala fire when there's a look on a face or a sound in the other partner's voice that sounds like a threat. So the reason that's happening, what you're describing, is that because of some history of mutual dysregulation, meaning where two people have been in distress or afraid too intensely for too long of a period, that begins to burn in and it gets rekindled every time there is a anticipation of the same thing happening. And so this is how people pop faster and faster into these high aroused states, high sympathetic states, where they're at war. And they'll even many times, while this is happening, think to themselves, how did I get here? How do I get out of here? I didn't really want to go here. On a nervous system level, this is what happens. We anticipate, help co-create through anticipation certain situations that that happen very, very quickly. Our ability to be able to correct those situations as soon as possible is the way out of that problem. We can't always deal with the reflexes because they're reflexes. But as soon as we can calm down, as soon as we can error correct, which is what my treatment focuses on, then the closer we can get to that reflex and we start to put that kindling out. So on one level, you have this threat response that people can get into very quickly after being with each other, and this is due to mutually dysregulated states that have been not fixed, not repaired. But then you have the opposite, too, and people who are very low on the energy scale, and they don't get each other excited in a bad way. They don't get each other excited in a good way either. They sort of stay in a very low arousal state, and these people have a very hard time generating any kind of excitement or a thrill or mutually amplified positive experiences that are lacking in this other situation.
Are you able to do anything with those low, what you call low arousal couples?
Yeah, actually, definitely. A therapist who understands psychobiology and is working not on the content level, but is working on the body level and working with attachment organization, in other words, how people have to move toward and away from each other based on early experience of being able to maintain contact with another person and to want to seek proximity with that person. We're pretty much prisoners in some ways of that template, that blueprint. Understanding that and then also understanding how the nervous system works, we can craft interventions to help move people up into higher arousal states if that's what needs to happen, or move them down. In the case of low arousal couples, they typically have very low contact, physical contact, and they don't seek it, they avoid it. And so moving them together in close physical proximity, eye contact is very stimulating. Moving them into positions where they have to make physical contact, and then working through the body states and the anxiety and the aversion feelings that come up, that's the work with these people. However, if the therapist doesn't understand this, they'll get caught up in what typically is a litany of housekeeping issues that these couples come in with. They're highly anxious people that can't seem to get things done. They're like parentless siblings who don't really know how to do things, but they're together, they get along, they just can't seem to manage day-to-day life.
I'm struck by your emphasis on face and eyes. You really say those play an important role in relationships, and I guess the face and the eyes are sort of the place where the two nervous systems interact quite a bit.
It really is fascinating. I mean, I've become fascinated with faces, and it's addicting. You know, once you start to really look very close up, not only at your patients, but also people you're talking to. I supervise medical residents through UCLA Family Medicine Program, and we videotape them doing therapy sessions with their patients. We do close-ups of their patients' face to give the residents an appreciation of the ever-changing, highly telling face through the fine muscles of the face and even the pupil dilation and constriction of the eyes. So it makes, you know, watching 60 Minutes and all those close-ups of people, all that very, very exciting, because you can see why the brain loves a face up close. The eyes delight in that. We, when we are looking at a face, looking at the eyes, we used to, you know, say eyes are the windows of the soul. That Alan Shore say this. They're really the windows to the nervous system, the autonomic nervous system. We're looking at real time at the nervous system reacting in the eye movement, pupil dilation, but also in the skin color changes in the face and the zygomatic muscles around the mouth and the orbicular muscles around the eyes. The face has so many fine muscles. And our eyes really, at close distances, can scan and see what's going on moment by moment, and we feel that in our bodies. This is part of the empathic system. Some people think of it also as the mirror neuron system, and though that part of that may be true, but there's much more to the empathic system than the mirror neuron system. And so when we look into another's eyes and face, at close distance, not only, by the way, is that how we fall in love, but that's how we start to interactively regulate. And by that I mean this is when two brains go on automatic, two nervous systems go on automatic, and there's this very quick dance, this process of attunement, misattunement, reattunement that goes on non-consciously, implicitly. When it goes well, when it goes badly, then everyone's aware. And it's through this mechanism that basically we can regulate one another. We can adjust and move and change according to what we're seeing. And we do this, if we're skilled at it, we do this without talking about it. We just correct it. We just fix it. And it's also through this close contact that we amplify positive feelings together. Unfortunately, it's also how we amplify negative feelings too, but we're looking for the positive that we amplify, and that's when we fall in love. That's when we talk about something that's really cool and exciting. We get on sort of a riff, and both are getting excited. We call this a dopaminergic surge, because there's this presynaptic dopamine dump in the brain, which gives us excitement and feeling of wanting to do this more and more and more. So the eyes and the face are really important, especially at close distance. At a further distance away, which is where couples go when they're in trouble, we tend to not see the subtleties on the face. We tend to look at the gross physical picture of that other person, and this is where we're more likely to make misappraisals based on prosody, just relying on the voice, or body movement and so on. We're not really keying in very closely.
You know, as you talk about the face, I'm thinking of the work of John Gottman at the University of Washington.
Oh, yes. And, I love Gottman stuff.
Yeah, I've wondered to what extent your work might be influenced by his work.
He's influenced me in a tremendous way. He's not only a really nice man, his work is wonderful. And his friendship and work with Paul Ekman has also influenced me. Paul Ekman is the guy who took Darwin's facial coding system and has standardized it. Now it is the facial coding system that's used forensically and used elsewhere. So him along with Ekman, working with the face, fascinating stuff. It was really John Gottman that started to bring research, real research, into what goes on in couples' relationship to light, showing us who work with patients, work with couples, the truth about what really works and what just doesn't work. You know, us therapists, we tend to have our pet theories and our pet approaches, and not being scientists, many of us will continue doing things for which there's no evidence that it helps or does anything. Maybe counter to that, it actually hurts. And Gottman really, you know, was one of the first, again, who really brought into the mainstream for mental health professionals this idea of, you know, let's really be careful about what we're doing here and see what really is happening, and work with researchers to look at the brain, to do things that we don't have time or not trained to do, and test out some of these hypotheses, these theories, and see, you know, what does work, what really doesn't work. And I think because of Gottman, there's been, you know, a wave of research now that's being done with video frame analysis, which is something I do, and biofeedback or neurofeedback equipment that Gottman is now paired up with Stephen Porges to do. The other therapists and other researchers are hooking up with scientists who've been really waiting to do something like this, to do fMRIs on mothers and babies, and that's Ruth Lanius' work up in Canada, and to really take this business of development, child development, psychotherapy, couples, and you know, pair with the scientists and start to do testing in these other areas, not just the empirical testing, but to see, you know, what really is going on, and how us clinicians can take that, working with the scientific community, to make our work more focused and more effective.
Yeah, that was always the goal, you know, the thought that the scientists and the practitioner could come together and inform one another. It sounds like that's really beginning to happen in a way that did not really happen very effectively for much of the history of the field.
It really wasn't happening. The scientists were not really cavorting with clinicians and then the other way around. I recently was at a conference, I just can't remember her name right now, but she's done some great work on the insula back east, does fMRIs, and her dance card is filled. She can't do anything more because, you know, people are, researchers are using her to do some studies, and so I thought that was kind of nice.
Yeah.
You got to grab up your scientists now if you want to do some research. But it's exciting stuff to know more and to understand more about ourselves and about the people that we work with and live with. And with this, you know, this neuroimaging boon, there's so much being done right now. Some of it we may look back on 10 years and see that, you know, it's either done poorly or we were on the wrong track. But at the moment, it's exciting.
Well, I'd like to go back to something you mentioned earlier when you were talking about the brain, and you said that the right hemisphere develops first, which is something that I wasn't aware of, and it makes me wonder about the distinction that Freud made between primary process thinking and secondary process thinking. And I've always thought of primary process thinking as baby thinking, if you will, and as sort of forming the roots of what we think of psychodynamically as the unconscious. So is it possible that the right hemisphere is in some way, quotes, the seat of the unconscious?
I think that's exactly right. I think the right hemisphere basically is Freud's unconscious. Implicit systems, implicit memory systems, somatic memory systems are all in the right. Stress regulation, cortisol production is in the right. Material that is unconscious and moves up into preconscious, we could say that, you know, preconscious is moving up into the frontal cortical areas, notably the orbital frontal or the ventral medial prefrontal cortex, where it becomes preconscious. This now we can pretty much say is the id is in the right. Ego here, you know, we're talking about, ego in the sense of executive function, the ventral medial prefrontal cortex, the orbital frontal prefrontal cortex, certain aspects of the anterior cingulate, the insula playing a big role in being able to read interoceptive cues. And the left, really, where analysis in psychotherapy and the CBT has been, which has been an emphasis on words and narrative and stringing sentences together that suggest we understand ourselves and our history and so on. While that's important, because the verbal centers, language centers, are mainly on the left, and this develops later in childhood than the right, we have a system that is much slower and has to first take this material that's coming from the right, this implicit material that's much of it is in pieces and procedural and body memory. And first it has to be organized in the right, and then be able to be brought up into higher cortical areas where we can reflect back on it. In other words, we become aware of our body, aware of what we're feeling in the moment. This is a skill that is that has, structural and functional correlations to it in the brain. And so when we're able to do that, we have to colossally, the corpus callosum, cross it in the front over to the left, where we have to then put it into language. And this process is not only very slow, it's problematic, because many times we're experiencing things for which we cannot give accurate enough words. So an attuned therapist, rather than being focused on the right interpretation or the good interpretation, is there moment by moment on an intersubjective level, on a feeling level, and is able to work with these implicit systems. This goes back also to some family systems ideas. When we saw that systems thinking was split in many different areas, cognitive, behavioral, unconscious, communications and so on. But the unconscious folk in systems really argued that, you don't have to have awareness in order to make changes. You have to work with these systems that are unconscious in an unconscious way through certain kinds of words, behaviors, interventions, and it's not necessary that they're able to sit there and now regurgitate to you exactly what they've learned. So this idea, and the traditional idea of psychotherapy, which is you're very focused in the left into thinking, into cognition, into being able to come up with a narrative, while that's important, it turns out, it seems more and more, that is not really where the work is. The work is, and especially with couples, it has to be in these very fast-acting, implicit systems that don't always have words or have narrative, and may or may not cross over into a narrative.
But boy, there are a lot of people who are involved in body therapies, somatic therapies, bioenergetics, yes, stuff like that, who would be rejoicing to hear what
and
you're
they are
saying now.
and they are.
Yeah.
And I'm somebody who, I'm not poo-pooing, narrative and being able to do talk therapy. But I think that that for a lot of people, the kinds of things that we see that are problematic in relationships, a lot of that stuff can't be touched through content.
Wow, that's really fascinating. Now, you've emphasized the importance of the maintenance of security. What about when one of the partners has been unfaithful? Are you able to help couples recover from that sort of breach in the security system?
Well, for couples therapists, that sometimes is the bread and butter of our practice. It's sexual problems and affairs, a good part of the population that comes to couples therapy, this is the story. And it's not just men, women too. Thinking in terms of attachment in particular and moving out of personality theory is very, very helpful when working with affairs. If you think of attachment as something that attachment organization that gets set and sort of hardwired in a certain way from very early childhood, we can understand the trajectory of a person unless they get therapy or have had corrective experiences. What they're going to have to do when they get married or when they get into a committed relationship, there are certain orientations, let's call them avoidant, on the attachment spectrum, avoidant, distant. These are people, you know, who are very accustomed to doing things themselves. They take care of themselves, they stimulate themselves, they soothe themselves. They're the go-to people for themselves, basically. Nobody can do it better than me. they come to the table threatened by commitment or dependency. And so they're very good in courtship, and they may be very good for a time, but we know that at a certain point, and marriage is one of those points, where that switch is going to flip on, and the person who they adored, the person who they loved to make love to, is now the person that they feel the most aversion toward, and they start to move away, and they start to back away. And this moves into every bit of their sense of themselves, including their feeling attracted to the other person. Attraction requires a certain amount of distance and a certain amount of oxygen in order for it to be there. If there's too much threat and another person feels intrusive, the first thing to go, other than one's ability to attend, is the sexual attraction, libido. So it is not uncommon for people of this history, attachment history, once married or even before, to have affairs. And one of the reasons they have affairs is not because they prefer the other person. It's because they have to move away from the orbit of that primary, that person who they are cheating on. This is not so much an attraction to someone or something, but an aversion and a fear of that primary attachment other, that person who represents, you know, mother or father, that is too dangerous. And so in order to seek out the excitement and the novelty and the thrill that they had before because now snuffed out, they go and search for excitement elsewhere. But this really is a function of neglect. People who do this, when we look at their attachment histories, and I do this with couples, we go through an attachment interview. And so we get an idea of who they are on that level. It becomes very clear, and this is not all cases of affairs, it's certainly not, but with many of them, we find that these people have a background in childhood of dismissive, neglecting parenting, where they spent too much time alone and had too much experience of intrusiveness or intrusive parenting, insensitive parenting. And so when they do come to depend on another person in adulthood, those fears come up once again. And they begin to look elsewhere for stimulation. They can't do it within that relationship. These people also have sort of a credo, which is very interesting. I want you in the house. I need you in the house, just not in my room. I want you in the house, but not in my room, unless I ask you. If I invite you, it's fine. But if you come in uninvited, and that could be a call from another room, yelling, it could be a knock on the door, it could be honey, then I feel attacked, threatened, and I want to be left alone. It's intrusive.
This sounds like what a lot of people would describe simply as an inability to handle intimacy, but it sounds like you have a more nuanced understanding of it.
not so much intimacy as it is an experience, a body experience of being used, and that the person who is approaching that primary isn't wanting anything that's mutual. They're wanting something that's for them, and so there's an exploitation piece here. I should say that insecure individuals live in a world of non-mutuality. They don't believe in it. And so when they get together, they tend to act in ways that are non-mutual, and they don't expect mutuality. So they are basically operating from a one-person psychological system. It's not, you know, what's good, it must be good for me and you. It's got to be good for me. Or it has to be good for you, but one of us it's not going to be good for.
Hmm.
So for this particular character that I'm talking about, they believe that it's always for the other person. That's one piece of it. So whenever you come to me, it's not that I'm afraid of intimacy. I'm being intruded upon by somebody who needs something from me, and there's nothing in it for me. I know this to be a fact based on my experience. And because I can't say no, otherwise it's a deal breaker, I have to comply, withdraw, ignore, get angry, whatever. The other piece of this is that people who are oriented in this way and spend a lot of time alone regulating themselves, they have a very hard time shifting their state. So let's say I am an avoidant, and I am accustomed to being alone, but I want to be with my partner. I have a tendency to shift very easily into the state I was in when I was very little, where I played by myself, fantasized, took care of myself. It's a very dissociative state. Moving into an interactive situation is hard. It's disruptive. I have to turn more of me on, and it's uncomfortable, and it feels like I have to give up something. Once I'm interacting, I'm fine, but leave me alone for 5 minutes, and I go right back into that autoregulatory mode, that mode of being alone, and I have a very hard time shifting back into interaction again.
Wow, this is all really fascinating, and
isn't it?
Yes,
now there are people who are the opposite end, people who are used to interacting, and they have a hard time shifting being alone, and so when their interactive partner leaves, they go into a dysregulated state because they have a hard time shifting and being alone, and they cling. So this idea of being able to shift in and out not only has a psychological piece to it, but it has a physiological, neurological piece to it as well, because it is felt as pain to have to actually shift the way your brain is operating, the way your nervous system is operating, into a different state, one that is particularly feels threatened. That's difficult.
Well, speaking of shifting, it's probably time for us to start winding down here. And as we do, I notice your doctoral degree is the PsyD. I have a certain number of students and people who are thinking about going on who are listeners and who ask about various degrees. And
right.
Usually the PsyD, you know, is associated in my mind with people who are not interested in doing research. Yet it sounds like you're very involved in research.
Well, you know, at the time I got my PsyD, I wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
Things changed. How I got here is a surprise to me. It's been a journey. So I don't think that having a PsyD, most everything I learned and did was postdoctoral anyway. But when I got the PsyD, I was afraid, basically, of doing, that kind of research.
Yes.
A time ago, and I was more a clinical oriented, and so I ended up doing my dissertation. Ended up being on a clinical case on closet narcissism. I'm glad I did it, and I don't regret it. I think. If I were to, I wouldn't do anything differently at this point. If people are, they know right away they're interested in doing research, then a PsyD, I imagine, wouldn't be attractive to them. They would just go for the PhD. But But there are many people who either don't know or think that they're going to be more clinically oriented and do private practice. This idea is, this has been fine. I think there, and every now and then people mess up my credentials and put PhD instead of PsyD because it's still, even after all these years, PsyD is still not as familiar to most people as PhD.
Yes, I think it's, you know, it's not totally unusual for people to discover later on, maybe they either become passionately engaged with the topic as you did, or right. they encounter some very charismatic researcher and discover that the thing that they thought they didn't like, they like after all. And so yeah. students need to be open to that possibility. Hey, before I let you go, I know that you have a new book coming out that you've just co-authored. Do you want to tell us anything about that?
Yes, it's thank you. It's the book is Love and War in Intimate Relationships. The subtitle, I think, is it's a working subtitle, How the Brain, Mind, and Body Interact. But the title definitely is Love and War in Intimate Relationships. It's through W.W. Norton Professional Books, due out early next year, 2009. And my co-author, Marion Solomon, who is kind of the grand dame of couples therapists, she's written several books on couples and couples and narcissism. She is my partner in this book. And it's going to focus on a psychobiological approach to working with couples, using attachment theory, autonomic nervous system regulation, and therapeutic enactment. And so for the reader who is intimidated about neuroscience, it's going to really break it down into very understandable terms in terms of for our purposes, how the brain works, how the nervous system works, everything you and I talked about, but in ways that that are relevant to working with couples. And there's been a lot of really great feedback so far from people who have read the chapters. So,
well, we'll look forward to that. And, boy, you're really on a fascinating frontier here. And Dr. Stan Tatkin, thanks so much for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. It was so much fun.
I hope you found Dr. Stan Tatman as fascinating as I did. If you're married, I suspect you were listening very closely. In fact, this might be one of those that would bear some re-listening. I have to tell you, I felt so smart when he responded positively to my suggestion that the Freudian unconscious might lie in the right hemisphere. I really continue to be amazed at the specificity with which so many of my guests are now able to talk about the brain in relation to both psychopathology and psychotherapy. The field has progressed leagues beyond where it was when I was in school. I'm getting a great education through these podcast interviews, and hopefully so are you. But I almost feel that if I wanted to hang out a shingle, I'd need to go to graduate school all over again. And at this point, I'm not up for that. Once was enough.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember what you seek is what you find. Dr. Dave is here to remind you it's all in your mind.
There's a new poll on the Shrink Wrap Radio website that I'd really like to get your input on. In the previous poll, you might recall, I asked how many would be willing to pay for premium content if I were to put the archives and a lot of this behind a password-protected wall. And about a quarter of those responding said they would. It's not really the way I'd ideally like to go. You know, I'd like the content to be free as it always has been. However, keep in mind that I've been spending about 10 plus hours per show for almost 4 years now to bring you all this wonderful content. So I'm considering going to a donation model. You wouldn't be required to pay for content, but you'd be asked to make either regular or periodic donations. In return, I would stop the other advertising you've been hearing at the beginning of the show, as well as the mentions during this portion of the show. So please take the poll and let me know what you think. And speaking of wonderful free content, check out my latest interview up on the other podcast series at wisecounselpodcast.com. It's the interview with one of the grand old men of psychoanalysis, Otto Kernberg, MD, on transference-focused therapy. As a matter of fact, he was mentioned in this interview with Dr. Tatkin. Did you catch the reference? I thought about remarking that I had recently interviewed Dr. Kernberg, but decided against the name-dropping. The Top Spots widget on our site is a place where you can help support the show and advertise your blog, your website, or some other service at the same time, all for a mere $20 PayPal donation. And those ads stay up there for a long time, months, based on present experience. And right now, all the 10 spots are full, but you can bump somebody off and have your ad be there. Now, thanks to all of you who've taken advantage of the discount offers from our four current sponsors. And you'll find links on our website to discounts at GoDaddy, Brookstone.com, Budget.com, Car Rentals, and PetMeds.com. And using those codes not only saves you money, but also helps to support Shrink Wrap Radio. So go there and check it out. Some of those codes could save you a good bit of money.
Hi, this is Kira Van Nuys Martin, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Kira, mother of my two lovely granddaughters. Now let's read a couple of emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Harmony, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave, I'm still listening to your show. I recently listened to one of your very early episodes, episode number 3 to be exact, about the incident with the bully when you were in college. I absolutely loved your response to him after he smacked you across the face, after which you turned your head and said, 'Here's the other cheek.' Yes, indeed I did." She says, "That was very awesome. If I'm ever in a situation like that, I'm going to do the exact same thing. This response is very much in line with my philosophy on how to deal with randomly hostile people. That philosophy is that aggressive hostility is best responded to with aggressive peacefulness and or lovingness. This shows that you're brave and willing to face the person head on, but it also shows that you're not out to engage in a fight and that you're someone who is guided by ethics. For instance, the incident you described started off with a very common trigger. You innocently look at someone and next thing you know, they say to you, 'What the hell are you looking at?' I think the best response in this situation is to admit that you're looking at them, but to add some sort of compliment or expression of goodwill. So when the person says, 'What are you looking at?' you say, 'I'm looking at your hat. It's really nice.' Or you could also say, 'I was just thinking about humanity and how most people are quite lost and miserable. And I was just looking around at people and wishing happiness for them.' Well, I wish I had thought of that when I was 19 years old and that incident happened." Getting back to Harmony, she says, "The thing you said to this guy after he slapped you reminds me of a fight I almost got in but avoided a few years back. I was with a small group of friends and we were walking downtown late at night. We passed another group of young people hanging outside a club. I overheard one of them use the N-word, even though she was white, and I said to her, 'Hey, you shouldn't use that word. It's racist.' Then she started giving me attitude and yelling and swearing at me. She threatened to give me a beatdown, so I said to her, 'Go ahead, but I should warn you, I fight Gandhi style.'" That's great. She says, "Funny, huh?" Yeah, it is funny. "As she was yelling at me, I didn't say much, but a few times I said, 'You seem angry. Do you want a hug? It might help you feel better.' I think I also advised her to get therapy now. Even though I truly meant these things out of genuine concern for her well-being, I must admit that half the reason I said them was to piss her off. because I knew that she was trying to get either a hostile response or a passive, cowardly response from me, and me saying these things was just giving her something completely unexpected and strange. Also, I'm sure I sounded a bit condescending, so even with these types of responses, there is a danger of doing so in a way that is just about one-upping the person rather than being genuine. Yes, I think that's a good warning, and I think you were really skating on thin ice in that regard there. She finishes up saying, anyway, to wrap this up, I just wanted to say I like it when you share personal stories and experiences in your show. I also enjoy hearing listener emails. Both of these things give this show a much more personal, communal feel. Namaste, Harmony. Harmony, thanks for that feedback, and thank you also for that piece of advice. I'm hoping not to run into any more of those situations, but you never know. Next, we hear from Arlinda, who writes, first, let me say that I recently discovered your podcasts and have been catching up on many of them. They are truly outstanding. Thank you for enriching my mind and life this way. I've especially enjoyed tea and empathy, exercise and the brain. I plan to tell my doctor that if she'd told me all along, exercise or be stupid, I would have been much better about doing it. The happiness hypothesis, your show is going to cost me a lot on Amazon because I had to go buy that book right away. And as a practicing Buddhist, I have to give a shout out to Buddhist happiness. I studied a little psych in college. In fact, had I not gone on to design my own thesis project on propaganda, because it was the intersection where history, psychology, and sociology met, I would have probably majored in it. I was particularly interested in autism. When I was back in school in the late 80s, we learned that parents of autistic children show distinct problems in language tests, so it might be genetic. It could also arise from a trauma at a young age, so it might be environmental. It might have been something to do with the brain's ability to control its floodgates, so it might be a neurological defect or brain injury. It arose exclusively in boys, so it might be tied to sex hormones. It could be treated with microphones that allowed kids to focus sounds. It could be treated by behavioral therapy. It could be treated with drugs or diet. It couldn't be treated at all. It's always seemed to me that this condition called autism really must be three or four different distinct conditions, all knotted together because of similar symptoms. And it seems that maybe psychology is headed in this direction. That's all rather ironic because at the time I was dating and have now been married for 10 years or so to a guy who many years later would be diagnosed with high-functioning Asperger syndrome. In other words, I didn't go for the research, I went right for the fieldwork. Most discussions I can find on the web for Aspies are directed at raising your Asperger's child. That's probably a result of the recent boom in diagnoses. But those kids do grow up and fall in love. There are very few resources on being married to an Aspie. One thing I can tell you is that total honesty is required, plus an ability to accept someone for who they are at any given moment. So in many ways, the teachings of Buddhism help me. Buddhists and Aspies probably make pretty good couples. We do, in combined dating, cohabiting, and marriage. We've hit the 20-year mark. That's a long roundabout way of saying that there are at least a few areas I would love to hear you explore. Obviously, Asperger syndrome, particularly as it relates to adults. Any new research in autism would be interesting. I think our military has gotten stupider, or at least the leaders in World War II. We had serious propaganda effort, but now I think we just bomb and shoot without bothering to persuade. Nonetheless, it would be interesting to take a look at how psychology is used in the real world, such as marketing, political advertising, especially timely, and propaganda. Lastly, I'm interested in EMDR. I heard another podcast that had both a positive and a critical perspective on it. The critical interviewee's main point was that it was clinically shown to work, but not significantly better than any other modality. He recounted, and it might be significant, that the anti was a he while the pro was a she. He recounted treating a patient with OCD through exposure therapy. In a 5-hour session, the therapist and a partner smeared the patient's hands with ink and dirt and put gloves on him so he couldn't wash or rub and made him sit there until his anxiety went from a 10 down to a 3 or 5. Okay, that might have worked, but I was appalled at the sheer cruelty of the method. What about re-traumatizing the poor guy? How did he feel about the therapy and psych in general after that was all over? And what on earth would they do to treat a rape victim or a victim of childhood sexual abuse, as I was? Hours of violent pain? EMDR might not work better than exposure therapy, but it sure seems a damn sight kinder. I know exposure therapy probably wouldn't be recommended for PTSD victims of violence, but the therapist who practiced that and dismissed EMDR as a better treatment seemed awfully callous about it all. Anyway, EMDR still seems to get that new agey rep. Is it for real or no? Is it simply the same as traditional supportive talk therapy with a lot of extra unnecessary looking around? Oh, two other quick areas I'd be interested in hearing you explore. Recovering from sexual abuse and learning to create a healthy sexuality amid all of this society's messages about gender and sex, and also acupuncture for depression. I underwent that from a masterful guy who was both a licensed psychiatrist and also a licensed acupuncturist, and it was great. Oh, and yet another, I still can't stop thinking, wow, and this and that and this, it would all be so cool. While we're talking about sex, how about kink-aware therapy and sexual kinks in general? Pathologies or just preferring rocky road over vanilla? Coming from the Bay Area, you must be in the center of a lot of kink-supportive therapists. The rest of the nation isn't so lucky. I'm sure you're right. I have to say I haven't consulted them myself, though. Again, thank you for these great podcasts. I'm really enjoying all of them. All the best from a happy new listener, Arlinda, a.k.a. Southern Buddhist. So, hey, Arlinda, you got to catch up on all my back shows, not only on Shrink Wrap Radio, but also on Wise Counsel, because many of the topics that you were asking for, I have, in fact, covered to some degree or another. In fact, almost all of the topics that you mentioned, and we'll try to do some more as well. So that better wrap it up. I'm running long here. Remember, send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave voice messages for me on Skype where I'm Shrink Wrap. We have a phone, which is 206-337-0622. Thanks again to Dr. Stan Tatkin for sharing his psychobiological approach to couples work. And next week's guest is Silicon Valley CEO Nova Spivak, and we'll be talking about the intersection of technology, consciousness, and Buddhism. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.